Welcome to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. We begin today's show in the Actor's Studio with Death Trap. Twin City Stage is bringing the Broadway hit back to life. We'll also be taking an up-close look at a variety of music through some fascinating lenses. Pianist, educator, historian, multimedia performer Pamela Howland takes us into the mind of that cantankerous French composer Claude Debussy on the heels of his 150th birthday. Then we'll taste the spirit of America, sampling from this country's amazing patriotic music tradition dating back to pre-revolutionary times. From drum and fife, we're on to musical form with Karoff at the keyboard. And he's a living legend in the world of jazz performance. Dozens of his compositions have become jazz standards performed every day by musicians all over the world. The great Wayne Shorter is here to talk music, philosophy, and life. Next on Triad Arts Up Close. Death Trap by Ira Levin is one of Broadway's greatest hits, and it's coming to Twin City Stage in Winston-Salem, directed by Joe Nearly. The show opens tonight, September 14th, and it'll run through the 23rd at Twin City Stage. Death Trap is part hilarious comedy and part gripping thriller that'll have your head spinning by the end. Sidney Brule is a playwright struggling to find his next big idea. When a former student comes to him for help with his own potential smash hit, the audience finds out just how desperate Brule is for fame and fortune. Joe dropped by along with TCS actors Tim Austin, who plays Brule, and Brandon Samples, who plays his student, Clifford Anderson.
You don't know who's going after whom. And that's the thrill and the mystery of the play. And in this scene, the older playwright, Sidney, has given a pair of handcuffs to the younger playwright, Clifford. And what you find is that Clifford can't get the handcuffs off.
They look so old.
Well, they were made to. And apparently solid and escape-proof.
They certainly seem that way.
Be my guest.
You mean, put them on?
Yes. That's what I mean when you're holding my prized pair of $1,200 Houdini handcuffs, and I say, be my guest. Put them on.
$1,200? Wow.
Now, turn your wrists like this, press, and pull. You didn't do it right. It's got to be a single quick motion. Try again. Turn, press, pull, all in one.
Nope, they're not opening.
They did for me yesterday morning. It's not a question of they're not being oiled.
I guess I'm just not Houdini.
Well, it's all right, I've got the key here. Somewhere. Don't go on fussing with them, you're liable to ruin them.
Sorry.
Key. Key. Where are you, little brass key?
Do you know, well, this could be a good thriller. It could. I mean it.
How so?
Well, a young playwright sends his first play to an older playwright who conducted a seminar that the young playwright attended. Nobody else has read it, and then he comes to visit the older playwright to get some ideas for rewrites. When he brings along the original and all his notes and everything. Of course, you'd have to have the Xerox breaking down to explain why there are only the two copies. And the play would have to be a very good one. The one the young playwright wrote, I mean. And the older playwright would have to have nothing much going for him at the time.
An enormous concatenation of unlikely circumstances, don't you think?
Yes, maybe. But we've almost got it here, haven't we? Well, the only difference is that you've got the drowning wife and the Houdini play, and Death Trap probably isn't worth killing for. I'll bet nobody even saw me getting into your car.
Well, there you are. You've licked the second play problem.
Tim, I gotta say, Sidney doesn't seem like the most likable guy. Tell me all about him. This guy, Sidney Brule.
Well, he's not really a likable guy. He's made his name and fortune off of other people, I believe. He had one great success, and there's a big question mark there as how he actually got that success. But he's very arrogant. He's pushes forward. I mean, he's driving towards regaining a high position in his profession, being at the top. And he's not at the top now and is desperately trying to get there.
You get a little sense of the desperation in your read there. Very well done. you've performed with so many companies in the area. I got to ask, is there like a little, when you first get into a new company and you're the new kid on the block, is there like a hazing process you got to go through? What's that like when you're,
Not really a hazing process, because, you know, all actors go through that, you know, changing companies, and every time you do a show, it's usually a new group of people. Yeah. So you're all, you know, meeting and learning about each other, you know, for the very first time as the process goes on. And hopefully in each group, you have people who are there to work with you, and I found that to be true.
So, well, Brandon Clifford's not the wide-eyed idealist. They're not the nicest guy, maybe, too.
Yeah, he is. He's a younger guy who definitely idolizes Sidney, the older playwright. And I mean, in the scene we just read, he's there to kind of get Sidney's input and see what this, you know, person who he's idolized and put up on this pedestal has to say about his work. So, yeah, he's a little naive. He's a little overzealous. There's a few things. So without giving too much away, you know, there's different tons of levels going on there. But, yeah, he's definitely just like Sidney, looking to be successful.
But you don't seem like a couple of evil guys. What are you drawing on there, Brandon? I mean, you're a nurse student, for gosh sake. So you can't be too much of a meanie.
I think the script offers it so well. The writing is excellent. So much of it is just from there. And then you've got our director, Joe, who is like, I know it kind of looks like that, but try it like this. And then you go there and you're like, that was interesting.
Can you be typecast in theater as they are in film? And people are always saying, oh, you know, you did this right. I have to say no to this role because I don't want to get locked in. I mean,
definitely. Trying to find work as an actor is very much a networking kind of venture. And some people in that network you meet for the first time, and there's a lot of those. So those people have no idea who you are. It's their first impression of you. And that's where you're going to be kind of put in their mind of where they see you as a character. The more people know you and might see you in different things, they'd be open to the idea of, okay, he played this at one point, but he could go to a completely different place in this other character. Mm-hmm. And it's worth the risk or the, you know, the effort to try it.
Say, Joe, directing, what are the big concerns when you've got that much responsibility and you're heading a project like this?
Well, I think the big concern is bringing all the elements of the production together, the technical and props and costumes and the actors. And luckily for me, if you do your job right in the beginning and cast it correctly, you don't have that many headaches. And I think this cast is superb.
Is that really 90% of it is getting the right people in the right roles?
88% of it, yes.
Okay. Okay, I'll take that. You know, this was billed as a comedy thriller, not hearing too much of the comedy there. What's your vision for Death Trap? And what would you like to see come out of this that, you know, really you need to leave listeners with?
I'd like the audience to leave thinking, wow, that was like a roller coaster ride, that it was one minute you think this and the next minute that, because there are so many twists and turns that you think you're following the plot of who's doing what to whom, and then all of a sudden the playwright shifts it.
My thanks to Twin Cities stage director Joe Nearly and actors Tim Austin and Brandon Samples. Death Trap by Ira Levin is one of Broadway's greatest hits, and it's coming to Twin Cities stage in Winston-Salem September 14th through the 23rd. You'll find links to ticket information and showtimes at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Last month, the world celebrated the 150th birthday of French composer Claude Debussy. On the heels of that birthday bash, coming to the Triad is a unique concert of Debussy's piano music with film created and performed by pianist Pamela Howland. The program begins with an 8-minute drive-by documentary with highlights of Claude Debussy's life and music. That'll be followed by many of the great composer's best-known piano works performed live by Pam Howland and all set to an original 40-minute filmscape. The performance is titled Reflections in the Water. It'll be Sunday, September 16th at 3 o'clock in Brendel Recital Hall in the Scales Fine Arts Center on the Wake Forest University campus. For this program, Reflections in the Water, it seems like what makes it really unusual is the format.
I have designed two films. One is a very quick, what I call a drive-by documentary. It's a mini documentary of just 8 minutes long that will give people a context who don't know anything necessarily about Debussy's life and the influences on him. And so that will take the audience through that very, very quickly. And then we have a piano recital, me playing all solo Debussy piano works, with a continuously running film that I've designed in the background. I've played the piano since I was a very little girl, and I love the piano, but the piano recital as we know it, I think, is a little bit off-putting, certainly for the performer and oftentimes for new audiences. And what I'm looking for is not to have people focus so much on me, oh, look how fast she's playing, look at this amazing thing she just did, because that takes them out of the experience of the music. I would like to create an experience that they are part of, which I think is what Chopin and Debussy and all the greats were looking for. They were trying to lead people into their own inner journey. We don't want to bore anyone. I'm sad to say, I think that classical music does have that sort of reputation of being uptight and a little boring at times. But it's not, you know, especially if you really know the story behind the music and the people. So, you know, again, I'm looking for as many entry points as possible to get people to come away from this experience saying, oh, I didn't know this. I want to find out about that. Or, oh, that piece of music, that was in a movie I loved. You know, so they're going to put it on their iPod. They're going to maybe resume playing the piano. I've had a surprising amount of people come up to me and say, oh, I used to play, or my mother used to play, and I'm going to start taking lessons again. Do you think I could do that? And I always say, yes, of course you could. My piano music is accompanying the images, but the images also will accompany the music. And the images are made up of beautiful nature footage that some very gifted cinematographers from UNCSA have provided. And also, these nature images morph into Impressionist paintings. They morph in and out of important artworks of the time.
The dreamy quality of the music, the sounds that he generated, pairs so nicely with this whole Impressionist movement in visual art. Debussy loved paintings almost as much as music. Then why did he rebel so much against this whole label of Impressionist composer? He seemed to kind of be
hand-off. I think he rebelled against just about everything. He was a very taciturn. It was just really a unique kind of loner character, and he liked to disagree. I think he was one of those characters. It kept him away from others. I think we see his true warmth in his relationship with his daughter, Shushu, who you'll see in the film, and in his music, of course, the true warmth that comes out in his music. Yeah. But he was a disagreeable character, and his father had wanted him to be a sailor. And he had thought when he was a youngster, well, I would like to be a painter. But once his genius was discovered, when he was about 9 years old, it took him all of less than a year to come up to speed to get into the conservatory in Paris, the Paris Conservatoire. And he actually studied with a woman who claimed to be a Chopin pupil. So there is this tremendous, beautiful sense about Debussy where we see in him, he's a composer in his own present times, the late 19th century and early 20th century. But he's got a direct link to Chopin, so he kind of takes off from where Chopin left off, and then he opens the door to things like jazz and direct descendants like Gershwin and all the way down to, you know, Stravinsky, Copland, and modern jazz.
Well, let's get into the music from that perspective, because he picks up the baton from Chopin. How did he move that baton forward?
He was very experimental harmonically, not in the same way Chopin was, but in terms of scope of genius. He went in a different direction, but he also really understood the piano. He has this amazing grasp of what the piano will do. He's a very, very pianistic musical composer, and he's using the piano in new ways, but it's always in a beautiful, flowing, melodic way. Well, I shouldn't say it's always melodic. He does get into some kind of interesting pointillistic things. But it has that sense of Chopin being the consummate keyboard artist.
This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and I've been talking with pianist, educator, and multimedia performer Pamela Howland. Her upcoming performance, Reflections in the Water, celebrates the life, times, and music of 18th, 19th century French composer Claude Debussy. Pam will be back after this short break for more on this fascinating pioneer. Later on the second half of the show, I'll get up close and personal with one of the 21st century's leading composers, saxophonist Wayne Shorter. I hope you'll stay with us. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Here's the second half of my interview with pianist Pamela Howland. Her multimedia tribute to French composer Claude Debussy happens to coincide with the composer's 150th birthday, but Pam has idolized his music since she was a teenager. Let's get into the program a little bit, beginning with the prelude from the Suite Bergamasque. This is from 1890, and he later revised it around the turn of the last century. Right off the bat, we hear this interesting choice of scale, and it generates interest. What are some of the telltale signs for you, the pianist and scholar, when you hear that, that's Debussy?
Well, one of the things he did in his harmonic experiments was to bring two unusual scales into contemporary writing of the time. Now we don't think anything of, we hear pentatonic music all the time, which, of course, is a very ancient five-note scale. If you find the five black keys that repeat and repeat on the piano and, you know, you play on those and you sound really good, that's the pentatonic scale. That's how you find that. That's a very open, almost Asian sound, if you will. And he brought that into the music and also something called the whole tone scale. We call it whole steps. So on the piano, two notes that are right next to each other are a half step. And if you add two of those together, it's a whole step. So if you stack up a series of those, it gives a kind of ethereal, unearthly, dreamlike sound. Now, we take those sounds for granted, but we have to remember that Debussy didn't have any guides. He was bringing this into the music himself, and he literally formed many of the modern music movie conventions that we have. We hear something on TV or movie in a soundtrack, like Dreaming. That's a whole tone scale. Sounds like Claude Debussy. Or the idea of waves crashing, water lapping, rippling fountains. You can trace those musical images back to him.
How did he work, Pam? When you hear, for example, Reveries, the next piece in the program, it sounds like such a beautiful, flowing, effortless melody that's recognizable to many. Did he labor over that, or did it just spin off?
Well, he advised a lot of composers later in his life, don't work at it very much. You know, go for walks, go sit in a chair and dream. I think he did work very hard. I think he did not want people to think that he did. But I think he did a lot of composing, as Mozart did, away from the instrument. Then he would come back, and he wasn't a particularly prolific or speedy composer. He'd question himself a lot. But when you hear that effortless Reverie, which is from 1890, very early piece, boy, can you hear the tie-in back to Chopin.
Another from that same period, which may be the most recognizable of the melodies presented in this program, Clair de Lune, the Moonlight from that suite. It just seems so perfectly effective. Why has it withstood the ages so well?
That's a good question for all of these wonderful pieces that people can't get enough of. But I think that there is a flowing sense that we hear in Debussy's music. Again, we're not a spectator in it. He draws us in, so we're a part of this. I hear it, feel it as a body of water, maybe looking out at the ocean. But he draws us into this current, this flowing current, and I think that he takes us through time. He's a composer who can take all our cares away because he gives us, we're in the present when we hear it, but he gives us the ability to think about past memories and, you know, the future, hopes perhaps for the future.
You've mentioned the word cinematic with regard to his compositional style, and what springs to mind is the initial sounds in sails, the sound of this little wind puffs pushing out a sail. I wonder whether if I had no background, I would still have that association. I think I would.
I I think that you would, too. It's very hard for us to know because these things have been so commonplace in our, I guess you could say, collective musical unconscious. We take for granted certain themes that we've heard over and over, certain styles of playing. But I think that he was highly innovative at the time. And this is where his music works so beautifully with the art movements of the period. Not only the Impressionists, but the Symbolist painters and the Pre-Raphaelite painters were seeking something different, not just a replication of a still life, but that sense of capturing an impression of something. Okay, if there's a field of poppies, not just what does it look like, but how does it make me feel when I'm seeing that field or seeing that girl with the flaxen hair in that field?
Or hearing those bells through the leaves.
And that is an extraordinary piece from later on. Another thing Debussy did is have many textures. So in that piece, Bells Through the Leaves, we not only have the normal treble clef and bass clef staff, he puts an additional third stave on there. So you're reading music. There's the very high bells going on. There are booming bells in the middle and bass bells and a lot of textural things happening. So he's giving us a very cinematic, deeply textured, meaningful composition.
One of the big events in his life, and I know his sometimes friend Maurice Ravel experienced it side by side for a period of that, was the Great World's Fair.
The Exposition Universelle, or the World's Fair of 1889, there were pavilions from as many as 50 countries all over the world so that musicians, dancers, etc. came and shared their culture. Debussy, of course, was just kind of this itinerant composer who kept going back to the fair because he had to hear this music from Java.
My thanks to pianist and Wake Forest University professor Pamela Howland. Reflections in the Water is Sunday, September 16th at 3 o'clock in Brendel Recital Hall in the Scales Fine Arts Center on the Wake Forest University campus. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll learn all about musical form with Peter Karoff at the keyboard, and then composer, saxophonist, legend Wayne Shorter will talk with me about music, performance, education, philosophy, composition, and much, much more. He and his quartet are on their way to the Triad, but first, isn't it about time for a good march? Spirit of America is a free, family-friendly, patriotic live-action show unlike anything you've ever seen, and it's coming to the Triad. This weekend in the Greensboro Coliseum, Spirit of America will thrill audiences with two performances each day. Today, following this morning's 10:30 a.m. show, there'll be a 7:30 performance tonight, and on Saturday it'll be 2 p.m. and 7:30. Presented on behalf of the United States Army, Spirit of America features more than 300 active-duty U.S. Army soldiers in period uniforms reenacting key moments in history, along with live performances for band and voice by some of this country's finest performers. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And in the meantime, Spirit of America representatives Jeremy Kern and Courtney Whitman drop by to talk about it.
Spirit of America is a free patriotic live-action show. It is actually the Army's largest community outreach event. It travels during the month of September each year, normally to two or three cities. So this year we'll be here in Greensboro at the Greensboro Coliseum, and then we will also be in Columbia, South Carolina. And the show features a little bit more than 300 active duty soldiers that are all from the U.S. Army Military District of Washington. It features historical reenactments from the Revolutionary War all the way to current operations. And then it also features all of the Army's ceremonial units. So it features the U.S. Army Band, also the Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps, as well as the U.S. Army Drill Team.
Wow. And I happen to, as a former clarinet player, I happen to know just how competitive it is to get into the Army Band. I mean, they're fantastic musicians, obviously 300 active duty personnel, but these are the best of the best.
They are. The musicians that are a part of this show are world-class musicians. As I said, we only go to two or three cities, so we really have a unique production.
The drills, the formations, the patterns, is there a selection process within the military to get into being able to do that sort of thing?
There is. First off, these soldiers have have to apply to be in the Old Guard, the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, which is the unit that performs this show. They also have to audition if they're going to be a part of the U.S. Army Band or in the Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps. And then as far as the speaking roles in this show, they actually audition for the show in the end of July. Then they get selected from those auditions. They rehearse during the month of August, and then we go on the road in September.
Just seems so polished and well rehearsed, and you come away from it, I imagine, learning just a whole lot about a big slice of our history. It's a free event. I know that thousands will come. What can we look forward to?
Yeah, the first act is more of a history of the Army, and really a history of America. It starts out from the Revolutionary War and goes all the way into present day of where our Army's at right now. So you get to see a lot of simulated gunfire. You get to see a lot of we have people that rappel from the ceiling. We have all kinds of very visual things, and also little vignettes of different parts of wars throughout our history of America. And then we go into the second act where we have our ceremonial units that come out, like the Fife and Drum Corps, the U.S. Army Drill Team, the Army Band, and it's just something for everybody. That's the great thing about this show, is there's something for all ages, and that's what we love to bring to a community so that people can get an idea of what the Army is all about.
We've got a little 7-year-old at home. I'm wondering, in terms of the age spectrum, is it age appropriate for kids that young, or would you say 12 and above? What's your take on it?
I would say that there is a lot of loud gunfire in the show, so that's something to be noted when it comes to smaller children if they're sensitive to loud noises. And we say that it is a family-friendly show, but again, just be sensitive to the fact that it chronicles the history of our Army. So there is going to be a little bit of war fighting in there, as well as loud gunfire, but it's a very educational show. It is a very family-friendly show. It's great for people of all ages. There's something that everyone will get out of it, and it really just stirs the patriot and everyone.
In addition to the Drum and Fife Corps, and we talked about the war reenactment, some great vocalists.
So there's a unit of the U.S. Army Band that's called Downrange, and they do a little bit more of the modern day music, and that's where you'll see the vocalists. They do songs and dance, and they have a good time with it. But they're amazing musicians. They're amazing singers. This is what they train year round to do. They are singers for the U.S. Army.
We get drum and fife, we get amazing music, we get war reenactments, costumes, we get lectures, people rappelling from the ceiling, and it's got to cost me an arm and a leg, right? Just be honest, Courtney, tell me.
It's free. It's completely free. All four shows are free, they're open to the public, but a ticket is required for all four shows.
This is a great way that people can come out and see their Army. We have a lot of opportunities where people actually get to meet soldiers, shake hands, talk to them, get a hands-on with soldiers. Because even though we talked about in this area, there are a lot of veterans, but there's also a lot of people out there that don't have that experience. And this is a way to really get to know the U.S. Army and to get to see a soldier and get to see him in uniform and get to talk to him and actually know that, sometimes you see him on TV and that these are real people and from their community. And it's just a great way to get to know your Army.
My thanks to Spirit of America representatives Jeremy Kern and Courtney Whitman. Tonight in the Greensboro Coliseum at 7:30 and Saturday the 15th at 2 p.m. and 7:30, Spirit of America will thrill audiences each day. Inspiration, entertainment, and history all wrapped into one amazing and free patriotic live-action show. More information is available on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a quick 60-second timeout right now. When we return, our good friend Peter Karoff is back with Understanding Classical Music and a look at classical forms. And then he's played with Miles Davis and Art Blakey, co-led the band Weather Report, and released over 20 albums as a band leader himself, winning lots of Grammys and awards along the way. At 79 years old, his career is still headed for outer space, with new commissions from the Los Angeles Philharmonic and Orpheus Chamber Orchestra just this year. Mr. Wayne Shorter talks with me on the second half of the show. I hope you'll join us. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and I'm happy to announce that it's time for Karoff at the Keyboard. Today, pianist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Karoff helps us to understand that often elusive subject of form in music.
Today, I'd like to talk about musical form. sometimes forms a little bit hard to perceive for listeners, and I just wanted to clarify what it's all about. Basically, it's just the big picture of the entire musical composition, how the beginning maybe relates to the middle and maybe relates to the end. Sometimes you'll hear a piece and the opening will come back at the end and there'll be a moment of recognition and you realize, oh, I've heard some music, I've heard some different music, and then the beginning comes back. That moment of recognition is perception of musical form. Congratulations, you can tell that how the piece is put together. Let me show you an example. So there's a little piece of music by Schubert. So it starts in the way we just heard. It goes on for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, and it comes to a close. But it doesn't stop there. There's a section of contrasting music. And so on. That goes on for another few minutes. It comes to a close. And what do we hear but our old friend, the beginning? And so on. So there's a wonderful example of ABA form. A couple of minutes, 2 or 3 minutes of one idea, one mood, a contrasting section in the middle, and then a very gratifying sensation for the listener when the material you heard at the beginning returns. And there's this moment of recognition. Essentially, form is based on recognition. If you recognize a returning piece of music, you recognize that, oh, I see something, some big picture event is occurring here. I want to show you another type of procedure, another type of musical form. This form or this procedure is called rondo. And instead of just ABA, what happens is it's kind of an extension of that, and it goes AB, AC, AD, and so on. What that means is an opening melody comes in, some contrasting music, our old friend, the beginning, comes back, some new contrasting music, and so on. Here's a rondo by Mozart, composed in about 1786. I'm not going to play the whole thing, but I'll sort of walk you through the form of it. Okay, so here's your A, your opening idea. Then we go on to a contrasting idea just a little bit later. And then that goes on for another 20 or 30 seconds, and you start to move towards a new idea. I can feel he's wanting to return somewhere. Yay, there's our old friend, the opening material. Another 20 or 30 seconds of that, and it closes. And now a new idea we haven't heard yet. And that material continues for another few seconds, and we find our way back to the A. Whatever the form, whether it's simply ABA, whether it's ABACAD, whether it's much more complicated than that, in order to perceive it, you have to pay attention. Unfortunately, we listen so passively nowadays to music that a very important aspect of music, this musical form, is quite often lost on us. So my injunction to you all is listen with attention, pay attention, and great music certainly repays as much attention as you can possibly give it. Musical form.
That's Steinway artist, pianist, and Wake Forest University professor, Mr. Peter Karoff, Understanding Classical Music on Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and I've got to admit, I'm pretty excited. You see, the first jazz tune I ever learned to play from memory at the keyboard is called Footprint. We're sampling from the first recording of Footprints made by the composer back in 1966. It's a pretty simple blues waltz with only four chords, but it's got this neat 3-against-4 thing going on rhythmically and this funky bass line, and, well, I've always loved it. But last week, you see, I got to actually talk to the man who wrote this great jazz standard, legendary saxophonist and composer Mr. Wayne Shorter. He's coming to the Triad next week. Wayne Shorter is truly a living legend. In the 1950s, he played with and composed for Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers. In the 1960s, he went on to join Miles Davis's second great quintet along with pianist Herbie Hancock, bassist Ron Carter, and drummer Tony Williams. Mr. Shorter co-founded the groundbreaking jazz fusion band Weather Report, and he's recorded over 20 albums as a band leader. He's also one of today's leading composers. Many of his jazz tunes, like Footprints, Speak No Evil, and Infant Eyes, have become standards, and he's currently working on commissions by the Los Angeles Philharmonic and the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. Next summer, Wayne Shorter and his quartet will be celebrating his 80th birthday at Orchestra Hall in Chicago, but next week, they'll be right here in the Triad for a rare performance in Waite Chapel on the Wake Forest University campus. The concert is Thursday night, September 20th at 7:30. It's a fundraiser for the Amazon Aid Foundation and Acre Plus Care, and a portion of the ticket sales will go to Amazon Aid. The current Wayne Shorter Quartet has been together since 2001. It's a talented young lineup featuring pianist Danilo Perez, bassist John Patitucci, and drummer Brian Blade. Wayne spoke with me by phone from his home in Southern California.
So there they are once again, the wonderful sounds that come out of the great Charlie Parker All-Star Organization, and to wind their little part of the deal up, let's hear, well, it's a privilege to hear the birds sing, Salt Peanuts.
It was like hearing something on the radio, you know, while I was an art major at Arts High School. I heard about the invasion, if you might call it like that, of a new kind of music called bebop. Some of the older residents in New Jersey, they were saying names, Charles Christopher Parker and Miles Dewey Davis, and at the same time, listening to a lot of musical, you know, scores, all of these things started to come together. Since I was an art major, the musical path is like a physical involvement, sort of like interacting with people, with exciting new innovation in the art world, where you can move around and had to interact with what I was hearing on the radio. And also, at the same time, I was collecting records from the library. Stravinsky, not just the modern thing, but you know, really opening up to the value of Mozart and Beethoven.
Was this all before you even picked up the clarinet? Was this in your teen years and all these things were coming to a head for you?
Practically at the same time, simultaneously, I got a clarinet and started taking clarinet lessons, but I would stop at the library and stay till the library closed and lay in the back rooms reading stuff about, you know, musicians 17th, 18th century and the difficult time that they had, even though they had patrons of the arts in those times. All that stuff. And I was thinking about the whole social implications with the influx of progressive jazz, bebop, and how difficult it was to keep it on the radio. There was an effort to curtail the introduction of this music on the airways. Talk about, you know, it sounded like chicken scratch and sounded like a lot of mistakes. And at the same time, I was thinking about the time when people threw tomatoes at the first of the Rite of Spring. Paris. Then, you know, I was thinking about, you know, the difficulty of moving things forward not just for the sake of art, but for the sake of the opening of humanity's eyes to change.
I think of your music, I mean, your compositions as having moved that whole conversation forward in so many ways. So many of the pieces that I love that you've written have become jazz standards. I'm just going to list off a few for listeners. Footprints, Nefertiti, Speak No Evil, Night Dreamer. They're so unique. What do you think has made them standards, Mr. Shorter? And what do you, just from your take on these great tunes that we all love.
Well, you know, when we recorded it back in the 60s, myself, Lee Morgan, and I would be in the studio recording stuff. And after we sitting there thinking about 20 years hence, we would say, what is this stuff going to be like? We were thinking like maybe this whole the efforts that we're doing might be dead and buried 20 years from now. So we said, well, let's do the best we can. So I'm not even thinking that we were aware of something magically in the works that would take hold to the generations because, you know, there was so much resistance to the popularity. You know, like, how many hits do you have in the world that's really, unless it stands the test of time, is still not at a place where you get masses of listeners and masses of people who ask for, I mean, music that's out of the comfort zone of their lives. You know, stuff that they hear every day on the radio. You know, the band I'm working with now, we kind of play stuff that is unpredictable because we don't rehearse. We don't know what we're going to do. I always say to myself, how do you rehearse the unknown? But then maybe that's what we have to do, deal with the unknown so that we can learn how to stay on our feet and not fall down or fall flat. Because we're out of our comfort zones, you know, we're all going to be astronauts and learn to dialogue with the unexpected.
Tell me about that, Mr. Shorter, because I love your quote in Ben Radcliffe's book, The Jazz Year, when you say you don't listen to music much because there aren't that many close sequences of chance-taking over any period of time. You said you have to wait until someone has the courage to come and jump into the deep water. And just as you're talking about there, to my ears, when I hear you play, you're jumping into deep water all the time, and now with your bandmates with this group. What's that feel like, and what's your mindset going into that big jump in performance when you're up on stage?
You need to make yourself vulnerable on stage. You can't try to put all of your musical training, the foundation that you have in music, don't worry about putting all that on display. You're going to have train wrecks maybe, and you're going to actually even demonstrate struggle when you're dealing with without rehearsal. But after the struggle, you got to try to break through to something called victory. The audience has been going with us, and after we finish, they say, we felt this struggle in certain places and everything. Then you broke through the sunshine. And these audiences that we've been playing to in Europe and lately in the United States, all relatively young. I mean young. I mean talking about when we had Weather Report, 15-year-olds, at the end, when I left Frederick, you know, we broke up and everything like that.
Yeah.
Age 15, 13, and then Herbie and I did a duet album, and we traveled around. We went as far as Argentina, an album called 1+1.
Yes.
Chile, young, some gray hairs and people and everything. Don't you remember when people? It's okay, but they, too, know that you're moving on, huh? Sonny Rollins said on a documentary, they asked him, why do you guys play progressive jazz or creative stuff? Why, you know, knowing that, you know, you're not going to have a hit. He said, well, we're playing so-called daring music, not to show off, not to show how great you are with your virtuosity and articulation and razzle-dazzle, that's my word, razzle, you know, acrobatic, musical acrobatics and all that. He said, we've been playing this, you know, new music to be human.
It seems like the struggle that you show in your playing and that vulnerability that you lay out there when you take a solo and now in your bandmates as well. But I'm thinking about you when I'm saying I've always loved that aspect of your playing. And I can see how that would be very attractive to a young audience looking for people to keep it real, as they're saying today. I think of a recent recording, not that recent now, we're going back 10 years to the Footprints Live and the experimental way you all approach that. It's exciting stuff.
Here's what I say. There's no such thing to me as a finished piece of music. You just stop writing until you tend to go on. And the comment is like, oh, someone is reinventing themselves. Reinventing. I don't think about no reinventing. I just think they're continuing. Hmm. And they're not just the same anymore. You continue. So I don't let the words like reinvent stop. The music that I've been working on is unfinished. It will appear again, grown up.
If you listen to this recording you did with John Patitucci and Danilo Perez and Brian Blade of Footprints in 2005, if you would have heard that recording back in 1966, you would have just thought, well, that's just a natural extension.
Yeah. This moving on, it's supposed to kind of communicate something to the audience that you don't have to discard something because you think it has no value, but you can graduate. I'm dealing with not letting the illusion of something take me away from what we call the mission. The illusion of something will stop some people. The illusion of getting older, say, well, I can't do that young stuff anymore. Those are my dreams, my young dreams, my childish dreams. It's not possible. So what I'm dealing with is that, yes, it is. It's possible. Let's go to fantasy land. And it's possible that reality is a fantasy and fantasy is the real reality. Yes, they did live happily ever after. You do live happily ever after. We are eternal. We just go to sleep. We go on vacation and then we wake up and continue.
I want to talk a little bit about this great band that's coming to Winston-Salem. But going back, you made your recording debut as a band leader back in 59. I'm wondering how your leadership style has grown or evolved over the years.
Thinking about the group that we have now with Danilo Perez and John Patitucci and Brian Blade, they're band leaders. Danilo goes out with his band and Patitucci and Brian Blade, of course. And then when we're on stage, it's a group of band leaders sort of saying, this is the time for every individual to be self-led. And that adage about too many cooks in the kitchen is a lie. A lot of cooks in the kitchen can work now, because the kitchen is the whole universe.
I can't wait to hear you all perform, but I mean, I'm just having seen each of you individually over the years. I just imagine the listening that goes on between you just must be at an incredible level.
When something's going on and someone cuts through what everyone else is doing, in the past, maybe it was taken as an interruption. Oh, you're interrupting my solo. But now it's like a benefit. It's like a donation to the mission. Then we have to interpret this donation musically in the part of the dialogue and saying, oh, thank you, let me travel with you, you know. And some people have been seeing that. They say, hey, John was taking a bass sort of like a solo or something like that, and then the piano came in and cut right through there, and then John just joined in. He was going left and he went right with the piano. Then the drum made a big loud boom, then you all got inside the boom.
Inside the boom. I love it.
Yeah, because they were saying they see pictures. And so when we do like a 90-minute concert, at the end, we get comments like, wow, if there's more, that was short. So we're saying, maybe that's like, if it's really happening, if it's good, it feels short. If it's not happening, it's really long. People start going to sleep and buzzsawing in the audience.
I have a feeling we're going to be wanting more. Young musicians coming up. I want to know how you came up in the jazz world, Mr. Shorter, and how you see today's scene for young musicians and the impact that the music educational system's having on young up-and-comers in the jazz world today.
Okay, myself coming up, everything was really compartmentalized. There were the jam sessions where you got most of your improvisational, cutting your teeth on that. If you wanted like some real straight academic learning, to go into classical, but a lot of musicians learn to write, compose on their own by listening. Depends on the person. Myself, Danilo, and some other people, when we talk about music, the first thing I go to is, what are you reading? What kind of books are you reading? And I listen to what they're talking about, and then I start talking about when you play. I have a tape, the old dinosaur tape, of Charlie Parker giving a music lesson to a young person. I have another one of Lester Young talking, and another Bud Powell and John Coltrane. And they were all talking. They all went to the same kind of thing. They were talking about, Charlie Parker was talking about valleys and lakes and valleys when he plays. He had a very distinguished voice. And Art Blakey used to tell me that Charlie Parker could converse with anyone on any subject. But he said, when you play, he said, he's playing lakes, valleys, trees. Miles Davis used to say he liked the way John Wayne threw a punch in the picture. Miles said, I like the way he threw that punch. That's what he talks,
yeah.
And then he said, I like to play that. Here's a good one. Some young people were playing somewhere, and Miles was in the room. Hey, Miles is in the room. And they played. When they finished, they went and approached Miles and asked him. One of the guys asked Miles, Mr. Davis, what do you think about my soloing, my playing tonight? And Miles just looked at him. He said it discreetly. Miles said, Do you talk to your girlfriend like that?
Wow.
The way he played. And he was saying it was all technique. And Art Blakey, I heard him talking about not just drummers, but horn players. Art Blakey would say, you play really well. You have a hell of a foundation and all that stuff. But where are you? Tell me a story. Tell me your story. Tell me. He said, talk to me when you're playing. He said, I don't see you until I start to see you. Then you're on your way.
Your music, for me, at least, creates its own sense of logic and beauty. And I think of a tune that I love so much, Virgo, just 100% original, Wayne Shorter. Could you tell me about that tune a little bit?
Oh, Virgo. Oh, I wrote it back in the 60s when I was making a comment on, trying to make a comment on the sign of Virgo. It's just the way it comes out, the way that the music goes. I didn't want it to sound like another tune. It's one time that it has a little mystique element in it.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound final, and it doesn't sound settling, but the unsettled quality has to burn, that has a flame of excitement that never really goes out.
Coming up on your 80th birthday, so you've been playing on and off the road for about 60 years, but here it is, 2005, you won the Grammy Award for Best Jazz Instrumental Performance, individual or group, for the Beyond the Sound Barrier, your latest with the quartet we're going to get to hear on September 20th. And the question was just how you keep your music so fresh, so relevant, year after year, decade after decade.
Yeah, well, right now I've been commissioned to write a piece for the L.A. Philharmonic Orchestra. working on a piece for the quartet I'm in. The entire orchestra, Ella Phil and Esperanza Spalding. We're going to premiere this at Disney Hall in February 2013.
With Dudamel conducting?
No, Vincent Gomez.
How do you feel about that? I mean, that sounds like a dream come true for a composer to be able to write for such a great group.
Well, it's going to be done after that. It's going to be done with the Detroit Orchestra, the Nashville, because they all joined in to make the commission possible.
I've heard of this, commission sharing. That's becoming pretty popular these days with orchestras.
And also we're going to be working with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. We're going to be at Carnegie Hall with them. There are 36 people. We played in at Lincoln Center, and about 12 of them came backstage, and they were excited, and they said, whatever you write, make it difficult. That's what we do.
Saxophonist and composer Wayne Shorter. He and his amazing quartet, featuring pianist Danilo Perez, bassist John Patitucci, and drummer Brian Blade, will perform in Winston-Salem on Thursday night, September 20th at 7:30 in Wake Chapel on the Wake Forest University campus. It's a fundraiser for the Amazon Aid Foundation and Acre Plus Care in conjunction with the Wake Forest Center for Energy, Environment, and Sustainability, the Office of Sustainability, the Department of Music, the Humanities Institute, WFDD, and the Office of the Provost. A portion of the ticket sales will be a contribution to Amazon Aid so you can enjoy an otherworldly jazz experience and help save the planet all in one performance. Lots of events happening prior to the concert as well. There'll be a jazz clinic and workshop with members of the quartet on Wednesday, September 19th at 3:30 in Brendel Recital Hall, a photography lecture on the rainforest by National Geographic's Sam Abel, and a talk on Wednesday at 5:30 at Kolinch Auditorium by the Humanities Institute's Karen Pincus titled No Return, The Humanities Confronting Climate Change. On concert night, there's a Seacrest Signature pre-performance talk Thursday, September 20th at 6:40 in the balcony room of Wake Chapel. In full disclosure, the speaker is my wife, Wake Forest University Associate Professor of Music, Jackie Carrasco. And on Friday, September 21st at 7 o'clock in the Byram Center, it's the documentary film screening of Amazon Gold, preceded by Center for Energy, Environment, and Sustainability Director and Professor of Biology, Miles Silman. Well, that's all for today's program. Our assistant producers this week were Eddie Garcia, Marian Wilson, and WFDD intern Natalie Barrett. You'll find podcasts of this program as well as past episodes on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. You can send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today for Triad Arts Up Close.